Muttassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So first of all, I just want to express my empathy for the suffering of all of you. Besides being very cold this evening, you've got two esteemed Dhamma teachers here sitting to my right, and instead you have to listen to me. Kind of like leftovers. Ajahn leftover. It's pretty cold. It's unexpectedly cold this evening. I think Lumpa must have had her sit outside this evening just so I wouldn't speak for very long. It's freezing. My fingers feel like they remind me of when I was a child in Minnesota making snowballs. Oh, God, it's cold.
I just had to go. Some gloves for
you. Yeah, thanks. No, that's probably against the vineyard, I think. I think it's probably just monastic life. We're not really allowed comfort. This was just finally it's not 110 degrees and it's freezing. Well, I remember the temperature reminds me of a time when I made my first big mistake as a novice. First big mistake, not only mistake. First big mistake as a novice. I remember in those days I was Ajahn Pasano's attendant or upatak for a period of time, and he, in the middle of the cold season, it was about this temperature in northeast Thailand. It was cold, and when you don't have sleeves and sweaters and all of that, you really feel the cold. And in those days, he would bathe outside with cold water. It was just a big earthen jar filled with water. During the afternoon work period, we would bring the water up from a well in these old metal buckets and carry them on bamboo poles and then empty them into this big earthen jar by Ajahn Pasano's kuti. And then after a long day of work and teaching, then when it was already dark like this, Ajahn Pasano would go outside and bathe, just with his bathing cloth on. And as his attendant, I would be there. He'd be taking his robes off and what I'd take them and carefully set them out and hand him his soap when he needed and hand him the scoop of water, etc. And, it's cold water on a cold evening, and he would throw the water over himself and go, "Oh, boy, that's cold." And I was thinking, well, it's just Dukkha Vedana. Don't make a big deal of it. And then he kind of take another dip of water and go throw the water on himself. Oh, boy, that's cold. And I'm like, look, why, he's supposed to be this tough forest monk. Why is he complaining? Just take it. It's just, we all have to bathe outside. What's the big deal? Or if it's so bad, bathe during the day, And so this was my first inability to comprehend how things work in Thailand, because what he was actually telling me was, as a Thai way of saying, geez, it would be appropriate if my attendant heated some water for me to bathe. And I'm kind of there patiently, silently saying, God, this guy's a wimp. What's to do is complaining about the cold water. So this thick-headedness was a trait at that time, and it's been a trait that I've gradually been developing, cultivating throughout my monastic life. So, yeah, it's cold. Cold this evening. I just hopefully keep you from falling asleep during the talk. Last year, Ajahn Jayasarawa came and gave a talk, and someone in the audience was actually snoring. I remember that, but. He rolled with it. It was good. There we go. So the fire element is a good contemplation for this monastery. Lack of it or abundance of it. It's Tejo Datu or Tat Phai. And for a lot of the rains retreat that I've been here, it was quite warm, you know. And I don't know, have you ever have those, you ever have sometimes a thought comes up, God, life just isn't fair. Life isn't fair. It's kind of a perception that arises from delusion and causes suffering. But sometimes it does arise. And you know, we go for whole stretches of time being over 100 degrees. Maybe there was like a week where it was 105, 110 every day. And, you know, I'd come to the West to escape the heat of Thailand. And we'd come down, and I'd come into the sala a bit early before the meal because it's very cool, or relatively cool in the sala. And come sit meditation and walk into the sala, and every seat was nice, cool, and in shade, except for one seat. There was one seat in the whole sala which had the sun beating down on it from the back window. You know, just one seat, and it just happened to be my seat. And I was thinking, God, you know, this just doesn't seem fair. But it's like, well, okay, just, you know, just go there and feel the heat, practice with it. It's just Vedan, all right? It's just, you know, paying attention to physical sensations and pleasantness, unpleasantness, comfort, discomfort. Besides, I rationalized to myself, I thought, well, when it starts getting colder, I'll be the only seat in the entire sala that's going to have sunshine coming down on it. And it will balance itself out, right? So just at the end of the summer when things were starting to cool down, they put up these awnings in the back, which prevented any sunshine from getting in. So, like, God. So I've been very impressed in the time that I've spent here. I have been here just about 3 months now, just completing the rains retreat. Feel a lot of gratitude for the Sangha. They've been extremely gracious and hospitable. It's an excellent Sangha. Really, I'm impressed in every way. No rush to go back to New Zealand, really, it's been a wonderful time here. It's been good for me personally, and everywhere I look, there's impressive things about the monastery. The physical location, you know, is excellent. It's a bit steep, but physical location's great. Quiet, you know, except for occasionally you've got the autistic donkey next door, but generally it's quiet. And you know, you practice with whatever conditions you have. But after living in Thailand, you know, when you come to a real quiet monastery, you really appreciate it. You know, and it does make a difference. We are affected by our external environment, and an environment like this is very conducive for developing internal sense of peace and internal quietude. Forest is excellent. Sangha is excellent. Really, the whole community here is very impressive. And the wildlife, you know. Every day I would see deer. And it's just so refreshing to have such a nice, congenial, non-violent relationship with other large beings besides humans. And there's big animals around as well. One day I came down, and right in the middle of the path from my kuti coming down to the sala was a big pile of bear scat. So it was like this calling card. And, you know, so every time I walked on the path, especially at night, there was an added incentive to be mindful. Because you know that at least once the bear used that path, so at any time I could encounter him again. So it's really great in the modern world to be able to have wild places like this. And it's really great that we can have forest monasteries in wild places. The training here is excellent. And, you know, really, if you look around to monasteries around the world, it's hard to find monasteries where the training is as good as it is here at Abhayagiri. And, of course, that comes down to a whole range of people. But, you know, one of the key figures, is Lhunpa Pasuno. He just has this ability to train Sangha. It's just amazing, you know. He's... there are any number of great teachers these days in Buddhism, but not all that many people who have this ability just to coalesce a very inspiring Sangha around him. So that's really something very, very special. And, of course, it's kind of building on the foundation that Ajahn Amaro left. And, you know, we're just so grateful for... Ajahn Amaro really lives on here at Abhayagiri in so many ways through the way things are set up and the support and the development. And then you've got Ajahn Yetiko, who's actually, he is so dedicated to this monastery, you can't believe it. He's so dedicated. Even up to the last few minutes before Ajahn Amaro's arrival, he was cleaning the toilet in the office after working all day hard. You know, he's working right up to the last minute just because he wanted to make it very, very clean and presentable for Ajahn Amaro. Actually, it was the second time the toilet had been cleaned. The life is really uncertain, but earlier on in the day, the toilet had been dutifully and very thoroughly cleaned by one of the diligent younger monks, but then for some reason the toilet had gotten blocked up, and Ajahn Yetiko was trying to unblock it. This was like shortly before Ajahn Amaro's arrival. And the whole thing exploded, and it was like feces all over the wall and floor, and the whole thing had flooded. And I was in the office, and I heard this kind of scream of despair, a mindful scream of despair. And so he's just like, meanwhile, we're tracking the arrival of the Lhunpas on the computer. Say, how close are they? How much time do we have to clean up this mess? We've got feces all over the wall and floor. We got it. So... But, you know, just that dedication to, I mean, he could have left it there and said, well, just, you know.
Live with it.
Yeah, live with it. He said, well, Lhunpa, he's probably not attached to anything right now. You're not attached to cleanliness, are you? A little A-super practice helps, always helps in monastic life. Yeah, right down the line, very inspiring. And then Ajahn Sanyamo. Ajahn Sanyamo is great. He's just so so pure-hearted and an excellent example and so much experience. I mean, you talk to Ajahn Sanyamo about forest tradition, and he knows a lot more than I do. I mean, he's just such an excellent example. He's very quiet and humble, and he really adds a lot to the Sangha, probably more than he knows. And then, I forgot Ajahn Kurunadamo, the most inspiring monk. No, Ajahn Kurunadamo he's just like so mature. I mean, compared to me, for example, And I'm not referring to years, but inner maturity and wisdom. And again, you know, just day in, day out, these guys really work hard to keep this place functioning. And, you know, probably no one except some of the other Ajahns realize how much work it is just to keep on top of the administration, to keep a place like this going. And people like Ajahn Yetiko, Ajahn Karun Adamo, just do a fantastic job. And Ajahn Jordi Palo, I mean, you know, he's been a monastic life over a dozen years now, and he's still sitting way down at the end of the line, you know. Still hasn't, all these years, he still hasn't gotten any closer to the shrine. You know, it attests to the depth of the Sangha here. And, I mean, you know, someone like Ajahn Jordi Palo, I mean, he's competent enough to run a whole monastery by himself, or at least, you know, my monastery, or Vimutti Monastery in New Zealand. You know, he certainly would be. And yet, you know, he's still, you know, just an average Ajahn way down the line here. So, you know, it's pretty impressive. And then you've got the newest Ajahn on the block, you know, Ajahn Nyaniko. Congratulations on your completion of your 10th year of monastic practice. Your Ajahnship is now complete. And so Nyaniko, he's the boy wonder. He was actually an abbot or a senior monk of one of our branch monasteries in Thailand. And, you know, it's kind of a tough monastery where when he's the senior monk, not everyone survives. It's a bit rough. But, I mean, the fact that, you know, you've got so much experience and depth all the way down the line. You know, I could go on, but you know, I'll stop there. You know, it just—I just say this so that people who come, you know, can appreciate that something very special is happening here. And because I'm a guest, I can—I don't have to be shy about seeing or praising things which are worthy of praise. Monasteries like this, they really do add a lot to societies. One of the traits that's really noticeable here is what we call samana sanya. Sanya means perception. Samana means one who is a one who has left the lay life, or maybe one who has decided no longer to follow the mainstream of the world, who has voluntarily decided to leave a life with different aims, different, as our chant goes, different aims and values. And you see that here in the Sangha. You also see it in many of the lay people who come to Abhaya Giri. So that's very impressive to see people who are clearly, you know, making a decision in their life that, no, I don't want to live just following my greed, my trying to fulfill desires, trying to be someone special. You know, we've been trying to follow our selfishness or self-importance for long enough to know that, well, it doesn't really lead to anything very worthwhile. So whether it's you know, the excellent monastic examples or some of the excellent examples of lay people who come to the monastery, it's very impressive to see people in a society like this that you know, really have seen the shortcomings, the disadvantages of the world, and really trying to make a sincere effort to practice the Dhamma and take the Dhamma into their hearts. And because it's, you know, it's not always easy, you know. And I've had kind of a special and privileged position or spot for this last 3 months. The Sangha has been basically said, well, you know, if you want to be on retreat the whole time, great. If you want to interact with the community as much as you want, great. So I could just find just the right balance. And even with near-perfect conditions, yeah, I'd be honest, it wasn't always easy. You know, you think that once, you know, when you're a junior monk, you think, oh, you know, once I get more senior, then I get the nicest kuti. You know, I get to stay in the nicest, biggest kuti, and then everything will be okay. But what happens is, you know, finally they put me in the elder's kuti, and it's like, yeah, it's too luxurious for me. It's like, yeah, you know, just dealing with my aversion to the, you know, the most luxurious kuti. And then I just kind of sneak around and I look at the kutis that the Anigarikas are in, and I think, geez, now they've got a really nice, simple kuti. So you know, it's just simple, nice. I can, you know, touch both walls if I stretch my arms out. Really nice. And nice dirt, drum-grown path, walking meditation path. And so there you go. You know, no matter where you are, you can always look at our relationship with our requisites of life. And are we content with them or not? So if discontent is in my mind, then if I'm in the small hut, I can think, oh, geez, you know, these senior monks living in the lap of luxury and the big elders could do, got their own shower, sink, fan, whoa. And then if I'm in the elders could do, I think discontent is in my mind. It's like, well, geez, it'd be nice to have a small, simple kuti, at least one with a view. And and it just goes to, you know, expose patterns of our mind, because the same patterns of mind can play out in whatever circumstances that we find ourselves in, whether it's a hut or our robes or a house or, and, you know, really, it's pretty obvious. We have everything we need to be happy right here and right now. And yet it's so easy to forget that. So I tried to remind myself that when it was 105 degrees and I was sitting in this only sunny seat in the sala. It's like, yeah, I have everything I need to be happy right here and right now. And it was true. And in the end, it's been a really wonderful time. Been a very, very beneficial time for me. So Samana Sanya, that's a quality that really stands out in a community like this. And you don't necessarily see it just because someone has ordained as a monk or a nun. But it's almost like an ineffable quality that you pick up in certain monastics, where you get a sense that, you know, there's a certain... they're just not buying into the world anymore. And they're really looking for happiness in a different place. You know, not just through trying to make things comfortable, trying to find the perfect temperature, because it's pretty much impossible, especially here. And or trying to, you know, find just the right external conditions, because it's impossible. Even if we find just the perfect situation, it changes. It's going to change. I mean, you know that. So this quality of samana sanya, still, it's a rather rare quality and something which we try to continually refine and deepen and ask ourselves, you know, where is our true refuge lie? Huh? Where is our true refuge? When the monks now just took their leave from me, blessing I gave was, you know, the Buddha is my refuge, my only refuge, and by the power of this truth, may you be happy. may be well. And same thing for the Dhamma and for the Sangha. And just kind of reminding myself of that. Now, where's real happiness? Huh? And the mind, as I say, my thick-headedness has been an ongoing trait. So sometimes I forget that and then start looking for happiness outside, or, you know, get fooled by beautiful sight, beautiful sound. But then it's always important to keep coming back and say, well, been there. You know, truly, been there, done that innumerable times. And just coming back to the sense of, why do I dress this way? Why have I left the mainstream of society voluntarily? I remember the first time I came back to visit the United States after I had ordained. My grandfather was ill, and I was walking down Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, I didn't really stand out very much on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, but I still felt self-conscious, or I was just watching the self-consciousness arise, because it was the first time in Western society that I had walked around wearing monk's robes and with the accompanying stares, etc. And just asking myself, well, why is it that I voluntarily, you know, why is it that I've dressed this way? Is it just some, you know, weird inability to conform? No, it wasn't really that. It was a bit more than that. It was, and just watching a sense of self come up and say, well, you know, what is it exactly? And then I realized that, well, okay, I'm wearing the robe of a samana. You know, starting to perceive myself as a samana, one who has, you know, left the mainstream of society voluntarily. And then wearing these robes is really like flying your flag. It's flying the banner of the Arhats, or, you know, you're flying your freedom flag by wearing these robes. And then I could really be at peace with it, because it symbolized things which are eminently worthy of dedicating one's life to. I mean, true liberation, a happiness which is not just based on getting what we want and avoiding what we don't want. And living with a sangha. I mean, it's just so rare, you know, in the world to find communities which really work and are inspiring and are harmonious. And as far as monastic communities go, this one is presently very, very harmonious. And it's very inspiring just to see that, because human beings have a tendency not to be very harmonious when they get together. You know, for whatever reason, human beings can find it difficult to live with other human beings. And so actually to live in a community where everyone is really dedicated and sincere about living in harmony, and whenever irritation or defilement of whatever time comes up, then, you know, there's a tremendous amount of integrity for not wanting to follow those, and for instead developing wholesome qualities of mind. So that's pretty rare in the world. And like I say, I know it's not just limited to the monastic sangha. So many of the lay people who live here and come to spend time at the monastery also exhibit those qualities. So again, to find a community which has a very high level of sila, just such a blessing in the world. Such a rare, rare thing. And when we see it all the time, we sometimes can forget what a rare blessing it is. And that, you know, even if that's the main part of our practice is just developing sila and virtue. That's already a lot. That's already very special. And it has a real protection around it. Just constantly refraining from making bad karma, but constantly doing our best to make good karma. And then in monastic life, there's innumerable opportunities every day for making good karma, whether it's doing little acts of service. Generally, the junior members of the society, of the community, are doing acts of service, washing bowls. But everyone does something to help the community and serve the community and help other people. And it's just like all day long, there's this opportunity for making good karma and developing good karma. And if that's done with a real sense of clear intention, I mean, the good karma just keeps building and building and building. And we really need that. I mean, there's no stage in our practice where we're beyond the need for making more good karma. I mean, up to maybe a certain high stage of realization. Because all the good karma that we make in daily life and practicing, even just with virtue, to say nothing of meditation, is like fuel for our vehicle, fuel for our car, and you do some wonderful acts of service, generosity, giving up, renunciation, and that gives a real energy to our practice. It gives a lot of energy and oomph to meditation. It creates a background stability, security, and sense of well-being. But then that can wear off as well. You know, if we just rely on our old good karma for too long, then that can gradually start to dissipate, wear away, and suddenly we find our mental and spiritual reserves, kind of disappearing. And so then it's always good to remember, don't let that gasoline tank get too low. We need to look for every opportunity we can to keep the vehicle running smoothly. Maybe using a metaphor of fossil fuels isn't the most politically correct these days, but it really is like fuel. Let's call it a hydrogen cell of Dhamma practice, or electricity, electric vehicle that's been generated through Abhayagiri's micro-hydro system. It's like this continual source of power, and monastic life is just so suited and designed to offer the opportunity for a continual level of making good karma all the time. And of course, the monastery is excellent for meditation. There are, even during the busiest times in this monastery, there's always a good group of people, a good number of people who are on retreat, just in their kutis, alone, come down, get the food, go back to the kutis, and the forest itself is large enough and secluded enough that when you're in your kuti, you really do feel secluded. So that the benefits that do come from kaya viveka, or seclusion, physical seclusion, you can feel that when you're on retreat here. And so there's a very nice balance. There's a lot of time for meditation for almost everyone in the monastery. The hardest ones are the senior monks, in terms of really finding time for them to recharge their batteries. But everyone is pretty careful to make sure Lumpa Pasano doesn't get burnt out, or Ajahn Yetiko get burnt out, or Ajahn Kurunadamo get burnt out. So, everyone gets retreat time. And that, again, in terms of making good karma and developing the path and being an inspiring example to everyone else, it really adds a sense of balance. And really, in Dhamma practice and developing meditation, citta bhavana, mental cultivation, there's that sense of balance is just really the key thing, and developing the skill of knowing what to do when and what types of meditation to undertake at certain times, and what brings the mind back into balance. And it's helpful to have a community which is basically, you know, in balance, and to be surrounded by nature, which by its very nature is balanced. And so it all kind of helps to bring the heart back to a place of balance where we can, you know, use the whole spectrum of tools that the Buddha offers in a skillful, wise way to keep finding that point of balance. And the mind's constantly trying to go out of balance, and then we kind of adjust it, you know, just watching carefully, and what does it take to bring it into balance, a place of peace. Once you start to get a taste for inner quietude and silence, times where thought isn't arising, when the mind and body feel very light, then it starts this positive feedback loop where you really start to see that, why would I want to do anything else besides Dhamma practice? So monasteries are very important in societies. And, here in California, I mean, there are a lot of good reasons to not be happy with the way modern society is going, modern American society, or want to change the economic system, change the injustice, work against the injustice, or in some ways be an activist. And I guess it when I was still a layman, I really considered, I'm passionate about saving the environment. I'm passionate about working or serving to try to in some way make the world a better place. But honestly, I thought that monastics probably had a greater effect, a greater depth of effect, or a greater ripple effect on making the world a better place. And in terms of cleaning up the environment, well, it was obvious where I needed to start was this corner of the environment, and that was something I could actually have an effect on, cleaning up, these five khandhas, and working on that part of the environment, because we are part of the environment. And when so many of the problems in the world are caused by greed, just one person consciously trying to reduce their own greed is a huge service for the world, for society. Even if we had a perfect economic system, we'd screw it up because we would still be coming at it with greed and delusion. And we'd screw it up. So really, a direct way to be an activist is to reduce greed in our own mind, and being examples of that, everyone benefits. The reason I bring this up, because I had just come from a monastic gathering, and there were some people who, some monks and nuns were really keen on, we should get out there and knock on doors and tell people about global warming and the injustice of the neo-capitalist economic system. It's a moral issue. We have to go out there in society and change things. And I didn't disagree with anything, but I started to reflect, on the things that they were bringing up and say, economic system, unjust. Well, who's actually doing something about it? Well, look, we got monasteries that are operating on dana. We don't sell anything. Everything's given free. It's not even trading. So we give everything away free. I mean, how radical is that? I mean, it's a total unconventional economic system where nothing is based on goods and buying goods and services. It's just based on generosity. Or so many of the problems in the world being caused by overpopulation. Well, look, the monks and the nuns are doing their job there. Look, I mean, it's like, it's like going, yeah, we got too many people in the world. So, well, look, yeah, we're actually doing something about it. And problems with the environment. Well, look at the forest monasteries. You know, as they were talking, I was reflecting. You know, in Thailand these days, or the whole time that I was in Thailand, about, you know, if it wasn't for the forest monasteries, there'd hardly be any forests left in Thailand. You know, it ends up being the forest sangha which becomes stewards of the real forest that's left in Thailand, except for maybe a few national parks. Still, you know, the people who are actually trustworthy and have a little bit of influence in society is really the forest monks. And even in America, you know, wherever we are, you know, outside of Asia, we're, you know, setting up large monasteries, stewarding the land, looking after the forest, tending the forest. You know, we actually care about the land. You know, and planting trees. We've planted over 10,000 trees in New Zealand. So, you know, we're actually doing something. And, you know, just reflecting that, well, it actually is kind of, you know, radical, or in the sense that, you know, we're not just talking about it, but, you know, the monks, or, you know, the Sangha here is set up, they're totally energy self-sufficient, or almost, between their solar power and their micro hydro. You know, what a great example is that. You know, they hardly need to burn any fossil fuels anywhere to support this monastery. And on, you know, through everything. But really, you know, it just like comes down to, in the end, if you have someone who's consciously trying to reduce the greed, you know, in their own heart, that is probably one of the greatest acts of wholesome activism, you know, we could do. And then naturally, you want to live simply. Because how much do we need to be happy, really? I was thinking, oh, geez, you know, if I only had one of those little, sweet little kutis like the Anagarikas do, then I'd be happy. But really, in the end, I had to be at peace with my luxury. But having said that, it's just being a model of simplicity. You know, when that's so important in the world these days. When we're obviously, you know, everyone knows we're raping nature. We're just ruining the earth due to having so much stuff, a desire for stuff, and to be an example of people who don't need much stuff. You know, people who are content with living simply. I mean, that's really a wonderful gift, service to the world. And it's a service to the world to have a community which isn't really proclaiming a lot of self-righteous views. You know, when we see, unfortunately, a lot of religious organizations in the world, or political organizations in the world, or people who are associated with religion and politics, just so view attached. It's just, you know, just the clinging to views just creates so much suffering. And the things people will do and the hatred people can develop in their own heart just because of attachment and clinging to their view. And the fact that other people have different views, and it makes them potentially feel insecure that other people may have different views. And of course, if they have different views and different than my view, then of course they're wrong, because I wouldn't intentionally hold a wrong view, so they must be wrong. And then in a community like this, of course, you know, people are developing samadhi. And it's a whole different way of relating to view, rather than saying my view. It's like, well, you know, yes, of course, we have to have views, you know, to make sense of the world, to have, you know, find our way within the conventional world. We can't just throw views out the window, but we can recognize that through our own misunderstanding or delusion, by necessity, most of our views are wrong by a certain degree. And we can't help it. It's just, you know, how we perceive things is based on having a mind that's not fully purified from greed, hatred, and delusion. So naturally, perceptions that arise from that, the thoughts that arise from that, affect the views that we have about the world. But a community like this, a Dhamma community, is dedicated to gradually refining our views so they do become closer and closer to reality, the way things are, and an attitude towards views which, you know, it's not self-righteous, it's not trying to prove someone else is wrong, but just seeing that just trying to develop a sense of letting go of clinging to views rather than enhancing the clinging to view, which reinforces a sense of self, which makes for bigger and bigger egos, which makes for more complaining and proclamation of whatever viewpoint people have. You have a sangha, a community, which is actually dedicated to undoing that process. It's just so refreshing. And then it's no accident that tolerance of other people and letting go of sense of self, you know, both come from insight that arises from Dhamma practice. So, of course, you know, you have a whole community that is kind of oozing tolerance. I mean, not all the time. Sometimes we get on each other's nerves, but generally we try to ooze tolerance, or at least work with it, work towards developing it. Okay, I get the message. Wrap it up, Ajahn Leftover. So, I started the talk by saying I want to empathize with your suffering of having to listen to this talk, but really what I feel most of all, I think, is a sense of mudita, you know, for people who are fortunate enough to be associated with this monastery, people who, you know, whether you live in the Bay Area or you're able to actually live here or you visit periodically. Yeah, I really have a sense of happiness for how fortunate you are to have a place like this as a resource, to have someone as special as Ajahn Pasano here as the hub of the community. Very, very fortunate. You can rejoice in your good karma of having a Bhayagiri monastery. So I offer this for your reflection this evening.